live with me in studio Friday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Radio Free Brooklyn.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
What would save the world?
Veganism.
Gun control.
Ending capitalism.
Consensus.
More guns.
Nonviolent communication.
Energy.
Green energy.
Spirituality.
More regulation.
Emotional education.
End the war.
Libertarianism.
On drugs. Socialism.
I'm Tuke Edelo, and this is
What Would Save the World on Radio Free Brooklyn every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the show. Today, our question is, the mainstream media barely spoke about the details of the situations in J20, Standing Rock, and they barely talk about Antifa. So if you don't know what J20 is, it was Donald Trump's inauguration, and Disrupt J20 was the protest of him and the larger systems he represents. And over 200 protesters were arrested in a mass arrest and charged with up to 7 counts of felony. And this has been going on since January 20th, 2017. And a lot of defendants don't have court cases until 2018. So their lives are pretty much on hold. And today I'm expecting independent journalist Natasha Leonard. And she covered some of the actions going on in D.C. on the inauguration. And she covers a lot of different things. She's worked for The Nation. She works for News Inquiry. And she covered on J20 the anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march, which is just about the nerdiest name ever. But whatever, I'm a nerd. So we're also here with Peter Soler, who's a J20 defendant. So he'll be telling his story a little bit. And there's actually this hilarious album by a bunch of J20 defendants called That Now That's What I Call Kirkophony, and Volume 1, which is like the name of the prosecutor. Well, but it's in his persecution. It's funny how that works. They did this album, and this is their song Jenny Low Blow. They call it like J20. They call it Jenny for some reason. I don't know, whatever, punk shit. Here we go.
Yeah.
Jenny Low Blow. Jenny Low Blow. Destination Low. Jenny Low Blow. Destination Low. Jenny Low Blow.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to What Would Save the World on Radio Free Brooklyn. And Natasha Leonard is here.
Hi. How you doing, everyone?
Hi. And we also have Peter Solar, J20 defendant and something else. What are you?
Media activist. Used to submit a lot of reports to itsgoingdown.org, the anarchist Antifa news site.
All right. Anyway, so like I said before, January 20th was Donald Trump's inauguration, and Disrupt J20 was the protest around that, a bunch of series of protests, but specifically what was called the anti-capitalist, anti-fascist march has had 200 protesters, like more than 200 protesters arrested in a mass arrest. And you actually covered this protest, right?
Right. So I was there as a protester and covering it because that's the kind of journalism I tend to do. And I'd been reporting on, the planning of Disrupt J20, which was, just a big, broad day of protest. So the fact that this has been turned around into a big sort of felon dog catching game has been really, really perturbing to see, because I was in that Black Bloc March and,
I was too.
And, so many people were and took part in it and were, cheering and waving and just sort of marching down the streets and doing what protesters do. So the idea of this being some vast conspiracy is, it's real, real grimy prosecutorial craft. So that's been really, really depressing to see, because I have a lot of comrades and friends who are under the gun right now.
Yeah, me too. And I'm actually very comforted by your openness about it, being like, oh, I was there. And so I feel like there's definitely a lot of paranoia around it. Like, there's this whole, like, apparently people tell me, oh, you're on the discovery footage. And I'm like, oh, what if they track me down? Like, even though I was, like, totally not blocked up either, though. Like, I didn't understand where I was going. People told me what it was. And then I was like, oh, it was
Wonder
one of
Around.
I was like, oh, it's one of these. Oh, I would have. But, and then people were like, maybe walk on the sidewalk. I was like, nah.
Because we don't have to walk on the sidewalks. That's not the law, especially not in D.C., where there are pretty open protest laws since the civil cases after the mass arrest in Pershing Square. So we hadn't seen police crackdowns like we saw on J20 since then. And those police crackdowns led to loads of new statutes having to be brought in because the city was sued and the police department was sued for an infirm mass arrest. And I think that's what we're seeing again here. But instead of us being in a position to launch a mass civil suit against the Metropolitan Police Department and against DC, we now have, over 200 people facing felony charges who are in the meantime petrified and politically silenced. So it's really, really upsetting.
It was an illegal arrest, right?
I think it was an infirm arrest, and it should be read as an illegal arrest.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, I think, to call it illegal is difficult because they haven't ruled it illegal yet. So I would allege that it's illegal, but that you kind of, it's the courts that decide what's legal or not, which is the screwed up thing about the law. that's how it works. But was it wrongful? Absolutely, because, one of the baselines of any arrest is that an individual has to have, the police have to have probable cause for arresting each and every individual. And that is implausible in this case, because what we know is that a number of people who were caught in that mass arrest kettle have already had the charges dismissed. For example, a couple of medical workers, legal observers, and journalists. So to me, that should be an absolute open and shut, closed case, that this was an infirm arrest, because if people were already released who were in that arrest, how can they say they had probable cause for each and every individual if they didn't have probable cause for some of them? So, this isn't about formal illegality and strong proof. It's about intimidation. And I'm sure that's what you're going through.
Yeah,
exactly.
What happened with the kettle? Tell us about the kettle.
basically, the MPD cordoned off an entire section on the corner of L and 12th Street in downtown DC.
And then they fucking, like, pepper sprayed everybody.
Yeah, they pepper sprayed everybody. They threw a flashbang into the crowd that was already, like, pacified and stopped. And, they let some journalists and activists and people out of the kettle because, I guess, like, orders weren't clear yet to actually close it off and keep everybody in. So, example, Lauren Southern.
That's what I was about to say.
Tim Pool.
Yep, snitches got free.
All the alt-right people got out of the kettle in the mainstream media.
Like, oh my God, Tim Pool.
Worst man in America.
He's such a little liar. Oh my God. Okay, so I'm going to rip on Tim Pool.
By the way, I worked at Vice with him. He was there when I was at Vice News.
Is he an asshole
in
person?
He's a garbage human. And an idiot.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean... He was at the Chernovich protest, and everybody started freaking out at him at the one on at Columbia. Mm. Michael Chernovich. Is it? I don't even know if I'm saying it right, but who gives a fuck?
I think it's Chernovich, but I don't think it matters.
Who cares? He's shitbag. So he was speaking at Columbia, and a bunch of people went up there to protest, and Tim Pool was there, and people were like, "Oh, what the fuck are you doing here?" He's like, "I don't work for the alt right. I was at Occupy." And then I was like, "These alt right people always get under my skin." And for a minute, I'm like, "Wait, what if they're right?" And I went and I looked him up, and I'd watched his shit before, and I'd seen him, like, you know, pal around with the Proud Boys and white supremacists, so I knew it. But then I looked back into it, and he was like interviewing Michael Chernovich and not asking him anything about, like, the quotes about white genocide or anything like that. He like put in a lot of effort to make him look good, and I was like, yeah, this is why people are mad at you, dude. Tim Pool, he sucks.
Yeah, he's one of the big people who's into that, like, shitty false fulcrum of, like, anti-fascism is not a war against fascism; it's a war against free speech, which is just like an absurd, like, through the looking glass moment we've fallen into that people are buying this fulcrum.
Yeah, what do you think of that? Like, I've been trying to think about ways how to talk people out of that. I've been telling people, like, oh, we already had these debates. Stop telling us to debate these white supremacists. These debates have been disproven over and over and over. Like,
well, I would say, I mean, there are a couple of good examples to call upon. A, like, historic examples of, fascist organizing being effectively shut down by the Antifa strategy. And the Antifa strategy is, above and beyond anything else, regardless of the tactic, about creating consequences that are felt by neo-Nazi white supremacists and their adjacent, like, lackeys organizing, such that the consequences make being in those organizing spaces intolerable. So that can include just, like, doxing or jostling or heckling or following. And sometimes it can and often does include, like, physical confrontation. But it's all about the strategy of consequences. So when people talk about debate and debating Nazis out of Nazism, and they're not understanding that fascism isn't a sort of well-organized political position. It's a sort of flow of sort of perverse paranoiac desires, as, like, Deleuze and Guattari would talk about it.
What was that?
Fascism as a set of practices and sort of perverted paranoiac desires towards power and oppression and suppression. So it's really not about a reasoned debate. It's about a sort of desiring space. So that needs intervening with in a way that isn't an appeal to, like, truth and liberalism, because it's not based on a metric of a truth epistemic. So there's actually really good philosophical reasons that Antifa practices are better than, like, liberal discourse when it comes to fascists. And you see it, like, I don't know if you guys saw that video of Gary Young, who's a Guardian journalist, did, like, a little video with Richard Spencer. And everyone was like, this was amazing, it was so great, because he was sort of saying, God, you know, you're such a racist. I can't believe you're saying things like black people benefited from slavery and I can't be a real Englishman because I'm black. You're talking nonsense. And telling Richard Spencer that he's talking nonsense doesn't make people who like Richard Spencer or Richard Spencer think he's talking nonsense. He's not going to change his first principles. So you see videos like that, and liberals love it, but I see videos like that, and I'm like, that's not changing anyone who agrees with Richard Spencer's mind. you're just saying he thinks nonsense. And they're like, yeah, we know you think that. So it's this incommensurate.
It's like
debate.
Masturbation for the left.
It's masturbation for the left. And then the right can watch it and think they're winning too. So that's why I think like people need to appreciate the actual like philosophical and theoretical base for being involved in Antifa practices and not involved in like free speech lobbying.
but
anyway, we can talk about that. Was a bit of a we can no, go back to your J20.
That works for I want to talk about Antifa because I spend a lot of my time trying to figure out how to explain Antifa to the general public in a way that they will understand, or in a way that will I actually want to figure out how to discuss Antifa in a way that will appease liberals. I don't want to like appease liberals, but I want to get them to understand. Because right now, currently, there's a comedian I know. I was talking to Peter about this before the show, who is getting tons of crap from the alt-right on the internet and shit. And she's like handling it pretty well, like just kind of giving him hell. But I'm concerned about her. Like, I'm concerned because I know that they dox people and I've had friends who were fucked with by them and stuff. So I'm like, I tried to tell her and she didn't really listen to me. So I'm like, I'm concerned with that people who are just like run-of-the-mill liberals don't understand the danger of the alt-right or the people who are in these groups.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, people don't understand the danger and they say, oh, look, they're really fumbling and they're fractured and like Steve Bannon's not even in the White House anymore. But none of the things around which they organize, which is like excluding othered people, excluding marginalized people, like hate, ressentiment, like chauvinism, misogyny, racism, nationalism, none of those like emboldened feelings are going away in America because A, they're not new. They've undergirded this country always. So the fact that they're emboldened doesn't mean that like the fact that the alt-right and the alt-light don't get along is proof that we're going to like undo the organizing capability of really violent, really discursively violent and physically violent racist people. And the discourse has become so ridiculous that, you know, you've got liberals getting more angry at leftists punching not just, you know, your standard run-of-the-mill Trump supporters. We don't have lots of examples of that. They're going, you know, the critiques of Antifa is if we're going around, or like people who are supported are going around punching anyone who may have ever voted Republican. There are just not stories of that. What we're hearing is physical confrontations with people at rallies holding swastikas and walking with torches and talking
Jews will not replace
exactly
us.
And blood and soil, which literally means cleansing the soil of all but white blood, like genocidal threats. And then the takeaway, not just from Donald Trump, but from like the fucking Atlantic, from Vanity Fair, is the rise of the dangerous alt-left not a thing because of like punching actual Nazis. Like not, there's not a lot of other groups getting punched here. And then, you know, in this time, there was someone outside a Milo rally, an Antifa, who was shot in the stomach by a Milo fan. That got like no attention at all. He didn't die, but he was hospitalized for 3 weeks in Seattle. So and then like someone punches Richard Spencer. I wrote an article for The Nation about how great that was and how beautiful that was and how like artfully timed it was. And there were like 6 mainstream articles written about how dangerous my opinion was. Oh, I mean, yeah. we're through a fucking looking glass.
I also loved, okay, when that video came out and everybody got released from the J20 holding, and the next day we all got in the car and went to go pick up everybody's shit and just watched that video like 10 times.
Right, did that feel that nice, really like good. When you after, came out of the cell?
Yeah.
Tell us about your day, actually.
Being in there for 36 hours, they took everybody's stuff. You know, some people got their wallets back, some didn't. I mean, if you had a camera, they took that as evidence. Yeah, they took everything on that I had.
They took your phone?
Yeah, they took my phone.
And they kept it, right?
They kept it.
And then you also lost your laptop.
Yeah, I had the laptop and the camera. I was able to get the camera back, but not the laptop or the phone.
Because they're using it for discovery?
I've talked to the prosecutor. I've talked to Kirchhoff, and she pretty much admitted that they lost it.
They lost it.
Yeah.
I it's so fucked up, but I also am like a little bit comforted by the incompetency of the entire system. Do you know what I mean? It's like, okay, so you guys just like really don't know what you're doing. But it's also, it was really bad. But like I was waiting outside. See, during the Women's March, I went to go interview people at the Women's March for about 5 minutes and was very, very bored and tired of the liberalism in the, within the first, like, I don't know, 10 minutes. So then I went back to outside the courthouse and I was, you know, on jail support, making sure people who got food when they got out. And we discovered they didn't even really feed you guys.
No, they didn't.
And somebody had like diabetes and they were like, oh, I don't have my insulin. And didn't they like just put her in like...
Yeah, no, they were taking... I guess it was Saturday night as they're letting people out. Sometimes they'd call us... We each had like an arrest number. So they would call us by arrest number to like go before the judge and get released. And sometimes they would just come in and call like a random person and just put them by themselves in like a solitary cell.
And you were one of the last people to be released.
Yeah.
You guys were released so fucking late. At some point, I thought you weren't going to get released. At some point, I was worried there were like priors or some weird shit. Mm. Like, oh, you didn't, they were going to try to get you.
That's also what didn't, there's people, there had to be people with warrants out. I know there's people.
Well, there was the guy, what's his name? The poor guy who already got charged, already pled out for assaulting an officer. Darren.
I know who you're talking about, but I don't know
what
his name.
Dane Powell. So Dane Powell got called back in based on a prior, I thought. Or was that?
No. What happened with Dane Powell is that
this is a guy, by the way, who was arrested on that day and has already pled guilty because he had one separate charge, which was assault on an officer.
Dane Powell was actually not kettled. He actually got out of the kettle and then he was arrested afterwards the next day when he went with his girlfriend who was in the kettle to get her stuff.
Oh, and no.
And they recognized him from...
Well, like his shoes or something unfortunate. Oh.
And he was actually in there for 5 days and he was released. With
my God. 5 days?
Yeah.
So unfortunate.
Oh, my God.
Always change your shoes.
I try not to even carry the same backpack, okay? Like, that's like... Don't wear the same shoes. Don't wear the same backpack. God. So I have something specific to ask about J20. Oh, what do you think is going to happen with all of this? Do you think that people are... I know some people are taking plea deals. I know that you've taken a plea thing, right?
No.
No?
I mean, I'm working on it, but we'll figure it
out. Oh, really?
Yeah. I think people are waiting to see what can be offered. And I think now... It's difficult, right? Because now we've got the first tranche of trials that started, because there are so many. So, for example, your trial, Peter, doesn't start even till next October,
A lot
right?
of people, yeah, a lot of people have trial in March, May, June, September, and October. And the last trial is October 29th, 2018.
So it's kind of crazy. But I think what will happen is a lot of decisions regarding what kind of pleas people would or wouldn't be willing to countenance will be determined based on what they see happens in this first tranche of trial. So say you've got your trial coming up in next May and you see the trial that's happening now end in an acquittal for the six people who are up now. Mm-hmm. You're probably less likely to take a plea then. You might still, but you might be less likely because you might have similar discovery to these people. You might be in a very similar position to these people. If you see that they were acquitted, you might have more confidence. If you see that they get, you know, convicted of a felony charge, you're far more likely to seek a plea down to a misdemeanor. So I think, and it really depends on the situation people are in, you know. Some people are at, you know, more legal risk, will have more effect on their employment, their financial future, you know, potential immigration issues in the future if they have, say, green cards and not citizenship. So I think, you know, it has to be, even though there's collective, you know, people are trying to be collective and support each other through this process, like people are in different situations and there will be different discovery against different people. You know, if there is a video of one person actively breaking a window, they are in a different, they have different leverage with the prosecution or less leverage with the prosecution than, say, someone who the entire video of them is just them marching and chanting and maybe wearing a bandana. So I think we'll have to wait and see. But I think this first set of trials, this first trial will tell us a lot. So I think people are on sort of tenterhooks around what happens with that.
I'm concerned about them targeting people they want to make out to be organizers, even if they're not organizers. You know, I'm concerned about them trying to target people who are clearly like visible in the activist community.
Well, I think a bunch of that has happened already. If you think about some of the post-Kettle, post-J20 arrests, a number of people who are just, you know, active activists in D.C., so therefore naturally were part of pre-inauguration protest planning, disrupt J20 planning, which is not illegal. I was at some of those meetings. Planning a protest is not illegal. They were picked up post hoc. And what is really gross with some of these people, with what's happening to some of these people, is that the prosecution are using videos, in some cases, that were captured by Project Veritas. Project Veritas being conspiracy theorist, troll monster right winger James O'Keefe's video series. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, they had plants and they definitely, you know, chopped up and edited these videos to make them look much more dangerous, even though they don't even. But we've got this funny media moment where at one point you've got the media like mocking Project Veritas for screwing up something last week when they were trying to do a sting and prove that a fake sexual assault claim against Roy Moore would be taken seriously. So the whole media is like, oh, ridiculous, Project Veritas can't be taken seriously at all. But now the prosecution in the J20 case is still using videos from Project Veritas about J20 planning in their case. So this is like, again, another one of those like incredibly creepy false equivalency things going on.
And the mainstream media is not talking about that. And it's barely talking about J20 at all, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, it was on Democracy Now! Like the other day, but is that, I don't even know if that's mainstream. I don't know.
That's what's really like unsettling about this whole like liberal resistance moment is that I thought naively that there'd be some kind of popular front or some type of at least attempt to bridge the gaps between like liberal and left in this like Trump era.
I did
but
too.
It seems. I think what it comes down to is just different goals and different. What they want is just a restoration of the Democratic Party, of someone like Hillary Clinton to be president.
Like the halcyon days of November 2016.
Well, people are like, Joe Biden might run. I'm like, are you?
Dreams right? can come true,
oh my
liberals.
My God. It's like, oh, fuck. See, like, I am such a no more presidents girl. I'm like not my presidents girl. But it's like, you know, like, fuck all of them. Everybody's like, oh, should we have a Harris? Should we have Sanders? And I'm like, fuck them all. Mm. They've all done like stupid shit.
I completely agree. I mean,
under the bus.
I'm still like, you know, given that we're not going to like crumble Rome in a day, like obviously would be like I was pleased. I'm a like, you know, no gods, no masters kind of girl. But I still, you know, I'm British, as you can hear, put my vote in, my postal vote for Jeremy Corbyn in England last year because, you know, we, diversity of tactics.
Exactly.
Of course. No, I agree completely. Like, I voted for Hillary Clinton in my old address in Virginia just because I knew that would be a powerful vote rather than, I hope that Donald Trump wouldn't win. But I was also I thought it was such a weird election that there was a chance Donald Trump would win New York because of all the people I'd met in Staten Island and people like in areas of New York who were pro-Trump. Mm. But he ended up winning and we all know what happened with that.
I just wanted to pick up on Peter's point about the kind of your surprise or like you kind of vaguely expected like in this Trump moment, you know, everyone was talking about, is he a fascist, a real fascist in the run-up to the election? You would think that would be like an aperture or an opening for like more pan-left liberalism, at least like not throwing each other under the bus. And I wrote a story the day before the inauguration that sort of ended on the note of like, I wrote like the decision to join the Women's March or disrupt J20 should not be a benchmark for division. This line instead should be only drawn when someone in the professed name of democracy would sooner condemn or even imprison anti-fascist, anti-racist actors before they would see a ceremony affirming and buoying fascism meet with interference, as in the inauguration. Mm. And I think, like, you know, I was sort of saying that rhetorically, like, there's no way, like, #resistant liberals and Women's March people would throw, you know, radicals under the bus for engaging in, like, you know, more radical protest. Like, surely in this moment when they're talking in alleged earnest about fascism. But nope. Liberals gonna lib.
It's so weird, though. It's like there's a, like, a tug and pull going on. So, like, in the immediate wake after Charlottesville, and, like, in terms of Trump's response and all of that, you had Time magazine be like, we're all Antifa now. And
all my, like, Hillary then, friends were like, I am Antifa.
Yeah, yeah. But then suddenly, as the week, as August droned on and everything, like, week after week, you start to see, like, a proliferation of anti-Antifa pieces.
Yeah, and like, so there was...
It's almost like these, like, progressive writers, like, kind of pitched this stuff. It's like, oh, we have to speak out against this. And then, like, the editors were like, no.
And
no,
then,
no.
Like, Jonathan Chait is like, no, but all this. But actually, yeah, FAIR, the, like, Media Watch organization, counted that in the month after Charlottesville, the six major broadsheets in the U.S. published 28... articles about the, like, worrisomeness and, like, threat of Antifa. So 28 anti-Antifa articles and only 27 articles about the problem of neo-Nazism and Trump's failure to call it out. So that's crazy. Like, actually, you know, this is statistics about where the, like, mainstream liberals and liberal center are leaning on this stuff. It's fucking mental.
So how do you think we, like, change the lingo? Because from what I see, that, like, a lot of activist anarchist lingo is completely inaccessible to the average person.
You, like, would think the term anti-fascist wouldn't be, though.
Yeah, but people don't even know what the fuck that means. Like, I talk to people all the time, yeah, and I start using words like fascism, patriarchy, white supremacy, and their eyes glaze over. Do you know what I'm saying? People hear these words as buzzwords and they shut down. And yeah, that's their problem, but what do we do about it? You know, when we're in this situation.
It's a good question. And I also think part of the problem with this is that, you know, someone saying I'm anti-fascist, you know, after, like, 1945, that's basically, like, the most banal political statement to make. Like, everyone thinks they're anti-fascist enough because they're, like, against the idea of Hitler. So when you say, like, anti-fascist but active, they're like, well, aren't we all anti-fascist? What are these crazy people doing? So I think we've got a problem there in that, like, everyone presumes themselves anti-fascist, so doesn't understand anti-fascist action because they don't understand fascism. They think fascism is just some, like, historically constituted regime, which it's not. So I don't know, but I don't know how to make things. I don't know. Like, I don't know how to make things clearer than, like, pointing out the amount of hate crimes we're seeing this year, and I don't know how much liberals need, but this isn't new. Like, in his letter from Birmingham, Martin Luther King, who liberals always tell us to look up to, he specifically said that the white moderate was more of a problem or as much of a barrier as the KKK to black liberation, because they are more, in his line was, they're in more in love with order than justice.
I agree with that.
And I think we're seeing, like, and that was 1963, yeah, and we're seeing it now. It hasn't changed.
I was recently hanging out with a friend, and I was trying to get across exactly what we're talking about here. I was talking about Antifa. I was talking about how I don't think that a successful movement is ever moderate or is ever, like, just, like, passive. I'm like, you can't have, like, a passive movement that's successful. And I was like, can you name me one successful passive moderate movement? And he said the civil rights movement. And I actually think I got out of the cab. We were, like, in a cab together. I think I just, like, got out of the cab, because, and that's also part of it. I think people don't understand history. I think people think that, yeah, like, the United States was always, like, anti-World War II, or that people were that, oh, well, when the Nazis did it, it was, like, an obvious genocide. And we nipped that in the butt. And people fail to realize, like, the parallels with Islam right now, about how, oh, because ISIS, everybody from the Middle East is terrible. And it's actually, in a lot of ways, as a Jewish person, I think it parallels the Holocaust much more than people want to even admit. Because that's how a lot of people in Europe viewed Jews, as, like, these secret Arabs who, like, appeared white.
No, and I think it's true. And I think also we've got, you know, there is this huge whitewashing. There's both, like, a whitewashing of historical resistance movements, like the civil rights movement. And I'm not even actually just talking about the important and necessarily work that, like, radicals like the Black Panthers did, and the, like, importance that riots played in, like, pressuring
Stonewall.
Right, and, you know, the when the year the Civil Rights Act was the Voting Act was passed was not just because of like a march on Selma. There were also major riots in every major American city. And even the nonviolence of Martin Luther King was predicated on bringing a spectacle of violence against the protesters' bodies that would then be seen. It was it was still predicated on violent interaction, but it was about the violence being brought on them. It wasn't about passivity. And I think there's a reason that's taught incredibly badly and whitewashed, because it teaches passivity, which is, you know, not an accident when
it is great for capitalism.
Right. But I'm curious, actually, like, with you, you know, you're walking around the world with all these charges now, where you found support that maybe you've been surprised, or has it all just been quite like within the far left?
It's mainly within the far. I mean, to be honest, even that took time to get together. So now for NYC defendants, there's a support group called Five Bark or Five Bro Anti-Repression Committee, which organizes a lot of J20 fundraisers. Old college professors. But it's basically people you're friends with.
Yeah.
The point is, it's like, how do we humanize this type of thing in terms of like, yeah, these are people you know, people you grew up with that are facing this. So
like, yeah, it could have been like just random person who ended up in the march who didn't even know what it was. Yeah. First of all, and even if they did, it does.
A lot of support is also coming from people, well, like yourself, who were there, or like Tuke, who were there but didn't get kettled.
Which could have, if I had turned one corner, mm-hmm. the police had covered the air with pepper spray, and you know, anyone could have been kettled.
A lot of people don't really understand the degree of how awful it was. I tell people about this.
And how random.
Yeah, no, people, it was.
They're like, oh, did they break the window? I'm like,
200 people can't break a window. And even if you did, you shouldn't be facing 85 years in prison.
I saw kids who were around that intersection who got pepper spray in their face. When they started like throwing the concussion grenades, I freaked out and started running because I thought it was like a bomb because I went to J20 kind of scared that like something really crazy would happen like that. So I ran and ran and ran, and I saw this mother and her child, and the son was like crying and like obviously had pepper spray like in his eyes, and she was like, "It's okay, honey. You're doing very good. You're doing very good." That was, I'll never forget that.
It was really discriminate.
I have PTSD from it. Like this 4th of July, it was like...
Oh, me too.
Yeah, it
me
triggered too. All that.
People thought I was insane. I was taking cover and stuff.
Whenever the fireworks were going off this summer, it triggered everything from J20. Because like, that's what people don't understand. It was like a war zone. It was indiscriminate in the way that they just attacked and threw flashbangs, grenades at everybody.
And a lot of the prosecutors keep saying to people on when they're trying to prove the like riot charge or the conspiracy charge, so they're saying like, you know, maybe you didn't break a window, but you could have left at any time. Pretty early on, the police surged and crowds were sort of squished and moved. Like, I lost my friends. Like, I have my partner's a very large person, so just like had me by the wrist and we stuck together. But it's like, otherwise, like, there would have been no way that like you could stay with them. And so people couldn't just like leave. Like we were really, even before the kettle, like there were like lots of, you know, consider this was also inauguration day. So there was a lot of streets were blocked off. Like there wasn't a lot of like, okay, I'm going to pop away now.
Especially because once you were in that black clothing, they were targeting you.
Right. And and you're allowed to wear black clothing. It's an absurdity. But I'm also curious like how it.
Especially in DC.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. Like they had very. Everyone sort of presumed that, like, even the people that were kettled, that it would be what they call catch and release, because that's been, like, the D.C. standard since all these civil trials lost them all that money after Pershing Square. So, I was texting my friend in the kettle being like, don't worry, honey, they'll let you go soon. And then, don't worry, honey, like, the charges will be, like, disorderly conduct. Like, I don't think we realized how intensely this administration was going to go hard immediately.
Yeah.
And I'm also curious if you want to talk a little bit too, because I'm like, I think we're talking about humanizing it. What it feels like to have charges like this hanging over you, like in day to day, like what does that do to your psyche?
It's crippling. But yeah, it just took time. It just takes time to get used to or just deal with it. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the interviews with like Elizabeth Legesse, who's been very vocal in the media about it.
Has it been difficult for you to make plans?
Yeah, definitely. It was definitely life changing. What do you
plan to do if the charges end up going away?
I mean, at the end of the day, what do we do now? I feel like for a lot of people, as this year is dragged on, especially for defendants, and we just see how much worse the society is regressing into this fascist direction, it's kind of like, I'm getting kind of dark here, but it's like, this isn't, even if we beat this stuff, we still have at least 3, if not 7 years of this, as well as like whatever horrible stuff is coming afterwards, because...
I mean, the thing that I always think about is, yeah, we have all this social stuff, we have all these things going on, but what about the global warming? Like, people...
Don't worry, we're all going to die.
Yeah, we're all going to die.
But, like, also horribly... You know what really upsets me? One of the last places that's going to be hit by global warming, and this is, like, if you want to talk about, like, pure proof that, like, the arc of history does not bend toward justice, one of the last places that will be affected by global warming is England. And I think if you think of, like, what that little shitty Fash Island has, like, wrought on the world, and that because of, like, various Gulf currents and its position in the planet, England will not be, you know, you're going to have the global south, like, decimated in so many poor countries, so many places that England colonized and, like, you know, completely decimated irreparably. And then, like, this little fascist island on which I was born is just going to be sitting there and, like, not affected in the same way nearly as soon, and you know, one of the last places to really be affected, and I'm just like, that is thanks. You know, that's terrible.
That's like the I feel like the European purists would look at that and like they would like use that as proof of their like,
yeah, they would think that their purity is like metaphysical, right? Like,
that's so fucked up. But I keep thinking about that though, really. I'm like, okay, while we're all talking about this stuff, which is really really important, like, New York's going to be underwater in, like, 30 years. And, like, I have a friend in Virginia. There's like, all these communes I used to live on in Virginia. And I was like, somebody I know inherited a bunch of money from his dad. And I'm like, oh, are you going to buy property in the area? He was like, no way. I said, why not? He's like, it's going to get hotter down here soon. And I'm not going to be able to get old here. I'll buy it somewhere where it's not going to get really, really fucking hot.
Take that, the Hamptons. What did you learn? But, you know, obviously, like, that's why these conversations about, like, social justice and how we organize life are so important, because, like, we need to find a way to live more collectively and sustainably.
Agreed.
And that will take, like, a radical anti-hierarchical politics in order to live in a world where, you know, global warming is real and we want to be able to find solutions to challenge it. Like, you know, when you're imprisoning 2.3 million people, that's 2.3 million people not in a conversation about how we're going to organize our lives in this world. Like,
and I really feel like I'm trying to figure out how to communicate anti-hierarchical like systems, not systems, but like groups of people, and like how to get people to start thinking in a way that maybe we haven't thought in before in a larger scale, like in at least in the West, like in terms of like United States, like everybody just like assumes we need to have like singular leaders, and everyone just assumes we need to have a hierarchy. Like, I don't really know what it's like anywhere else, so I have to talk about the West.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it's like anywhere else, and we don't really have, I think a problem is like whenever you talk about like communism, someone just says like, oh, go to Cuba then if you like that. And it's like, just like because we've had certain state communisms that have ended in, like, you know, for example, communist dictatorships, doesn't mean that, like, every potential political experiment would end up the same way. I mean, it is a problem that I don't have an answer to, because, like, we don't really have a political imaginary. It's really hard, even for us with the desire for it, to have a political imaginary outside of, the, like, the political categories we've been coded through and in. So, like, I don't know what it'll look like, but I know we have to, like, try.
Exactly.
But it's very hard to, like, I don't know how to, like, because it also depends on, like, who you're trying to convince. Like, if people are asking questions about, like, wanting to, like, deal with inequality and things like that, then, you know, that's a person you can start having an honest conversation with. But in the same way, like, we're talking about, like, not sitting down and spending our time trying to convince staunch racists. Like, I'm not going to spend my time in try and convince like a staunch capitalist who thinks he deserves his Goldman Sachs bonus. Like, I'm not going to convince you, but maybe I can be part of a movement that makes your decisions intolerable for you.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think they make the decisions intolerable and then mess with their organization. Like, right. Like you were saying, like take debt, like dox them, make it very, very hard for them to organize. But then I am still left at the end of the day with this question of like, okay, so once we break them up, how do we convince them? I keep saying you don't have an answer. I don't have the answer either. I just feel like there are important questions to ask. Like, what do we do after to make sure this doesn't happen again? Because it keeps happening.
Well, we haven't got to the first bit yet.
Exactly. We've never gotten to the first bit yet. Yeah, exactly. We've just like said that it was healed and then it hasn't been healed. And I feel like there's this hilarious myth of like, oh, the United States was started and it was this beautiful equal thing of like, oh, we have to go back to when America was great. I'm like, oh yeah, when America was founded on genocide. Right. Oh yeah.
Nietzsche calls it like it's what that is essentially is like social contract mythology. Like the idea that states were formed by like the like equally consenting voluntary bodies of people organizing to live in a certain way. And like Nietzsche actually talked about this and about like, you know, like this, he calls it like a romantic illusion that like there was this, that like the foundation of states came from anything but like the iron fist of power and like property ownership and then like control. So like I think this myth of social contractualism, it's not just like a, you know, make America great again racistly. It's like the liberal version of make America great again. Like there was no, and I see a lot of like writers I quite like being like, the social contract is being ripped apart. And I was like, there was no social contract. Like, if you're waiting for that to be true, you're waiting on a myth that was never there. Like, we haven't got one. So, yeah, I think that's also this problem, too, like, which is, it's ideology, right?
I'm really scared of what's coming out of this in terms of, like, the liberals versus the right and the left being completely wiped out. So it's like, I'm like, so if Democrats win in 2020 or they win in 2024, like what's next? It's like that's going to be the new thing.
Like that,
everything seems to kind of, especially with liberals, everything seems to kind of revolve around like the image of the Democratic Party as this wholly progressive alliance. And like,
how are we going to save the Democratic Party? I'm like, I don't give a fuck about the Democratic Party.
And what we've been doing is, what we've been doing since Occupy under a Democratic administration was to kind of keep pushing people to the left. And with Occupy, Black Lives Matter, 5 for 15, Standing Rock, all this stuff came to this explosion, which was personified in the 2016 election through Bernie Sanders.
And the thing is, and Corbyn, you know, could well be the next prime minister. And I do think, you know, if we've got, and you know, and I do give room, it's not the work I do, but I have room for like, you know, some of my best friends are in the DSA. Like, I have room for the work they're doing, like getting people in political positions, even if it is representative politics, that then, you know, people who, you know, if we had a Bernie Sanders 2020 and it was feasible, then we've got a much better, you know, interlocutor in terms of pushing much further and continuing to protest and continuing. Oh, yeah,
getting support from the DSA. We have that. In fact, a number,
oh, you've got support for J20.
A number of defendants are DSA. Too.
Right, that's the thing. It wasn't just like crazy anarchists. It was just like, you know, not that we're crazy, but like, you know, like
DSA is a mixed bag.
It's a real mixed bag.
It's a huge organization, though.
But so is Anarchy. You know, Anarchy Land is like, you know, I know some real dirtbags.
Oh the my left, god, anarcho-capitalists. That they're like the bane of my existence.
Just men.
I just
and all the, you know, and all the like, you know, horrible abusers and misogynists that I've like, I don't know, dated.
Oh, I saw your piece, and I was like, I felt so understood. I'm actually working on this thing right now about like how the alt-right confirmed for me that I'm a feminist through like observing, like because I keep getting like confused because they use really good like brainwashing tactics, I feel like, sometimes, like if they're like, oh, feminism is a myth because of this and this and that, and then I'm like, oh, but maybe I don't know, and then I hear like another story on the left, I'm like, no, it's a problem, this is a problem, like,
everywhere.
So it's kind of like solidified for me, like in this, like made me have to rethink it and then confirm it. But in terms of like liberalism and conservative, like people who call themselves right are like, liberalism is right.
is right wing at this point.
Yeah.
Like Gavin,
but it always was.
Gavin McGinnis sounded liberal. I mean, yeah, I guess. I don't really fucking like understand like liberalism. I don't even understand like what it is. It's just like this like fake, it's like an image.
Well, I mean, classical liberalism was free market. Was like the like the and so neoliberal. That's why people are like, what is neoliberalism? Like, it's not actually. Some people are like, it's just a slur. I'm like, it's not. It's actually like a way of describing something that happened in geopolitics, which was about nation states upholding legislation that enabled free market economics globally. Like, that is neoliberalism. It's not that complicated. Everyone's like, it's just a slur. And then like liberalism, little L, that people have been using in decades, and like meant as a good thing in America. Like, I think that comes out of the Red Scare and people being scared of saying the word left. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to talk about progress and they wanted to talk about little L liberalism, which, you know, actually they said had nothing to do with capital L free market liberalism and was more just about like progressive legislation and like inclusion of gay rights and inclusion of inclusion. Inclusion and not subversion of problematic status quos. But actually what we've seen is that liberalism actually is now historically unaccidentally aligned very much with classical liberalism, which is all about, you know, that kind of little L liberalism is fueling Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And Silicon Valley happens to be a hotbed of fascism too. So yeah. it kind of all melds together.
So like this idea of like nation states upholding like a global free market economy, like that's what people are talking about when they talk about globalism, I think, which is so funny because that's exactly what conservatives say they don't want.
That's what they don't want, but it's what they do want.
Yeah, it's all the same fucking thing. But the thing that's so, I just want like...
They just don't want Jewish people having any money. Like, it's like they're just, like when right-wing people say, when like we say neoliberalism, we actually mean a system that like buoys inequality and like creates these like a nexus between like capitalism and state power. When they say globalism, they mean they don't like Jews. Like that is that. Like
I mean, but it's the funniest thing to me is like the farther you go right and the farther you go left, you just hit anti-Semitism. That's like my experience as a Jewish person.
I've never seen that in the far left. I'm Jewish too, but I guess I've never felt it.
I guess it depends. I mean, I guess like I meet people who consider themselves to be very far left, who have a lot of Jewish conspiracies, a lot of conspiracy theories center around Jews. For example, like I've met a lot of people who participate in like Black Lives Matter, who believe that Ethiopians were the original Jews, which I completely agree with. I think that Jews came through Ethiopia and went to the Middle East and went up to, Russia. And that was the immigration pattern. And that's how this all worked out with Ashkenazi. But there's this like belief that the Jews the Ashkenazi Jews are like mutants that came out of the Kazakh caves and that we actually caused the Holocaust on ourselves to be able to seize the global powers in the Middle East and Israel.
Stop talking to the weirdos at the back of marches.
Oh, but they're so fascinating too at the
like,
same
no,
time.
No, and I don't want your newspaper.
No, and I don't want your newspaper. Oh my God. But that's actually a lot more prevalent than people think. Like
I didn't know that.
That whole cafe, the Commons. Have you heard of them?
Oh yeah, that was a problem. That was that was no platforming in action. There was a guy that was invited to speak there, who had a history of what, like a Holocaust denial.
Yeah.
And you know that was, and then a lot of us sort of boycotted the Commons, and that's how that works out. Like that's what you've got to do.
And I also find a lot of denial of Jewish oppression still on the left.
I think that's true. And I think you have to be careful. Like, it's one of those things like I'm sort of very careful with as a Jewish person, because I'm also like, look, I'm read as white. I live as white. I enjoy white privilege.
Exactly.
I'm not going to pretend. And I also don't want to like support that kind of paranoia that like bolsters a Zionism to be like, we're always under threat and as under threat.
Fuck Zionism.
Like anyone who can be othered can be under threat. But that's, we're talking about visibly brown and black people who live under the yoke of that far more than us. But, you know, I was in Berlin this summer and there was a real traditional neo-Nazi march, like proper, like commemorating the death of Rudolf Hess. And I've never felt more Jewish in my life, like standing in opposition in the streets to like actual neo-Nazis. But that's the first time I felt like I'm like a kind of would-be victim, target, not an ally.
Exactly. Like, I do feel like there's it's very important for Jews to acknowledge their white privilege.
Yeah. Or I mean, there are brown Jews, too.
Of course.
White, Jews like us. Yeah. If you can't see us, Tuk and I are like pale white girls.
Yeah. I could easily dye my hair blonde and like hide. But I have dyed my hair blonde, not to hide. I love being Jewish. But I still hear, like, on the left, I sometimes hear, like, people kind of, like, minimize the Holocaust and the suffering of Jews. But they don't minimize the suffering of Jews. They want to call out the suffering of other people who are targeted by the Holocaust, which is absolutely an important thing to cover. But people have said to me, oh, well, you know, Jews are one of the only oppressed groups that have ever been acknowledged on an international level. I'm like, that's just simply not true. Holocaust deniers are fucking everywhere, and that's all I gotta say.
It's true, and it's very worrying. And, you know, more and more in when we normalize, thanks to the New York Times this week, far-right neo-Nazis.
Far-right neo-Nazis.
As opposed to the far-left ones, just neo-Nazis.
There are far-left neo-Nazis. Well, the Illuminati people, some of the Illuminati shit is very anti-Jew, and I actually feel like there was this great zine I got at this anarchist book fair that was like about convincing people away from the Illuminati theories because they see it as like there's some truth in it, but it's actually sort of like a plant to confuse people.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm just meeting different leftists.
A lot of leftists who are like on point, who are talking the way we're talking here. But I've also met like the farther
the wacky fringe.
Yeah, the one who like became a leftist because they did acid while watching Zeitgeist and then Googled some things.
Yeah,
they became a leftist. I mean, that's pretty much what I did. I mean, but I found
but it. You just took it in a good direction.
Yeah, I moved to a commune, you know, lived in a Occupy, you know. So we're coming to an end here. We thank you so much for being here, Natasha.
Thank you for having us,
I'm so
babe.
Glad you're here. And thank you so much, Peter, for being here. If either of you have anything left to say, we didn't get to Standing Rock this time, but I don't really care because I feel like this was a really solid conversation. But it is important to note that there are still protesters facing legal troubles from Standing Rock.
And that'll go on for years in a very conservative part of America.
So you should look into that, because don't forget about it. Just because it's no longer a hashtag on Twitter doesn't mean you shouldn't know about it. It doesn't mean that it doesn't fucking matter. I get really tired with that, about like the trends of activism, of things that are like J20. Like, people talked about that for a while. There's a bunch of fundraisers. Sounds like it's still happening.
Yeah, same thing.
But I've noticed it sort of disappear a little bit.
He's just like, yes.
Same thing with Antifa. After J20, everyone's like, oh, Antifa, Antifa, Antifa. Then it died down. Then Charlottesville happened. And then it was like, oh, Antifa, Antifa, Antifa. Then it died down.
Yeah, and then all you
people
hear
forget about
then you
it.
All then you all only see Ben Shapiro owns an Antifa. He never actually owns them. He just like talks over them until they can't say anything or their mic goes out. All right, so we're gonna play out. Thank you so much for listening to What Would Save the World. We've been here with Natasha. Natasha, where can people read your pieces?
I mainly write right now for The Intercept. I write every couple weeks, largely about social justice, The Nation, Esquire, but if you want to like keep up to date, just follow me on Twitter at Natasha Leonard. That's LENNARD.
And if you ever want to be on the show, email me at tok@radiofreebrooklyn.com. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Coming up next, it's Brooklyn Bandstand with Tom Tenney. And I'm going to play out with Dolly Parton, a parody Jenny of Dolly Parton Mall from Kirkhoff. Now, that's what I call Kirkhoffy Volume 1. Here we go.